somewhere along the line, the church decided it would be a good idea to start calling them Saint Matthew and Saint Peter and Saint John and Saint Mark, etc. But if you think about it, the only thing that makes these 12 disciples remarkable in any way is the fact that Jesus called them. In fact, in their day and age, they would have been not the best of the best, because if the best of the best would have already been called out by age 13 to go and study with a rabbi, these were the guys that couldn't quite hack it and had to go back into the vocation of fishing or tent making or whatever their parents had done before them. But in and of themselves, they were highly overrated. They are no more special than you or me. In fact, they are you and me. So if you'll indulge me, I'd like to take a look at the disciples through the eyes of a modern-day recruiting firm to see how they would have fared had we had this available for Jesus in his day and age. Imagine the memo to Jesus from the Galilean Human Resource Management Consulting Firm. It might have gone something like this. Thank you for submitting the resumes of the 12 men you have picked for management positions in your new organization. All 12 have now finished taking our personality profile inventory tests, and we have not only run the results through our computer, but also have arranged personal interviews for each of them with our psychologist and vocational aptitude consultant. The personality profiles of each one of the 12 are included for you to go over at your leisure, and we think you will want to study them very, very carefully. As part of our service to you, we will make some general comments, and these are given as a result of lots of staff hours have been put into this at no extra charge to you. It is our professional opinion that most of your nominees for the position of disciple have serious deficiencies in background, education, and vocational aptitude for the type of enterprise that you want to undertake to change and transform the world. In addition, they do not show any signs of ability to work well together or have teamwork or any kind of group cohesion whatsoever. We personally would recommend to you, Jesus, that you continue with your search. Let's become a little more specific, though, Lord. Simon Peter, we have noticed, is someone that is very emotionally unstable, given the fits of temper and his serious impulse lack of control. Andrew has absolutely no qualities whatsoever of leadership. The brothers James and John place sibling rivalry and personal interests above company loyalty. Thomas is doubting. Well, his attitude will undermine morale over the long run. The Greater Jerusalem Better Business Bureau has blacklisted Matthew for unethical income tax practices. James, the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus, well, they're radicals, way out there, and score high on the manic depressive scale. Only one of the chosen 12 shows great potential. He is resourceful, has a business mind, is ambitious, highly motivated, and demonstrates an ability to work well with authority figures, something that might be helpful for you, Jesus. And so we recommend to you Judas Iscariot as your controller and chief financial officer. When you think about this, it's amazing that out of this ragtag bunch of misfits, Jesus was able to literally change the known world. What that says to me is that it's not extraordinary people who accomplish great things. It's ordinary people who find them in themselves, in the set of circumstances that they are in, the strength to do extraordinary things that change the way we see and operate in this world. I'd like to give you one classic example. I don't know if you've seen the movie In the Darkest Hour. It's about Winston Churchill. Right after Neville Chamberlain is given a vote of no confidence, the government has to reform. While Hitler's come to power, he's already invaded France and Belgium and other countries. And Churchill's the one that they pick for the Conservative Party. He's not elected by the people. He's appointed. And they're concerned because Churchill wakes up every morning and has this much scotch for breakfast. He then has this much scotch again at lunch, He has this much scotch again at 4, then takes a nap, wakes up, does some more work, and before bed has this much scotch. He does this, and everybody's amazed that he can completely function at all. Churchill was not the man that everybody wanted to be the prime minister during the Great World War. However, he was a man who rose to the occasion. And he had a quality of leadership that surpassed anything that anybody else offered at that time in history, which was he would not give up. He would not compromise on the notion that you could do business with Hitler. He would not negotiate with Hitler on a peace treaty to save Britain. He said, "We will fight in the streets, we will fight in the country, we will fight in the air, we will fight on the shores, we will fight everywhere." And his own party didn't want him because of this. They wanted to negotiate a peace. But Churchill refused to do that. And so for 4 years, he led his country through one of the greatest struggles the world has ever seen, one that we can appreciate because we were part of it, but not in the same way. We were never bombed. We never had thousands of troops try and invade our shores. But he did. And he and the king alone pretty much were it when they stood together. So when I look at extraordinary leaders, I don't look to people who are perfect in character. I don't look to people who don't have defects in their character. All of the disciples had defects in their character. Paul certainly had a defect of character. He was a zealot. He was killing Christians, and then he became one and became the greatest promoter of Christianity the world had ever seen. Likewise, Moses, greatest leader in Israel's history, murdered a taskmaster for beating a fellow Jew. These are not men and or women who are pure or without blemish. But out of this motley group of people, the Lord said, "You're whom I'm choosing. Come follow me." And you don't have to have it all together to answer this ad when Jesus says, "Come follow me." You just have the ability to put one foot in front of the next and see where it leads. In fact, I would suggest to you, it's your very idiosyncratic nature. It's your neuroses. It's all of those things that you would like to push away that can be your greatest blessings and strengths. That's what the Lord sees in us. The very thing that we don't want to have to face sometimes is our greatest asset. Consider Peter. It's not in spite of his emotional outbursts. It's not because of his impulsive actions, but because of them that Jesus is able to say, "And on him I will build my church." I will build a church on such a person. The founder of our church had a personality disorder, you could argue. He had emotion, he had passion, he had care, and he also was a coward. He ran away when the hour came and the cock crowed 3 times. Now, these might not be great qualities in middle management, but they are great qualities if you are starting something big, starting something that has never been done before. There's not a successful entrepreneur that I know of who is stable. Steve Jobs, the latest book with his daughters come out to describe what it was like growing up under Steve Jobs. Horrible dad. Horrible dad. Edison, horrible husband. Never around, but they were geniuses. They were geniuses. And they were not stable, and they were not conformists. The world was and is continually being changed by those who are discontented with the way things are and look at things and say, "Why can't they be different?" So what's my point in this? It's simply this. The church was founded on the likes of you and me. The church grew, and the world was turned upside down because of ordinary people with extraordinary defects of character and personality. For some reason, God said, "That's good enough for me." And it is our job, therefore, to trust that by answering Jesus' ad, "Come follow," we too have everything that is necessary to be a disciple of his. We've been given every gift there is. We gather here each week, therefore, not to warm our posterities and be reminded that we're all good people, which we are at times, but to be reminded that in order to be the first, we must be a servant to all. In order to really be a great leader, you have to care about the people in such a way as that you're the first one into the battle, not the last one ordering the troops in, and you're the last one off the battlefield, not the first one off the battlefield. In order to be a servant leader, you have to put the needs of your men and your women before your needs. If they're hungry, you feed them first, not yourself. If we had this kind of leadership in this country, think how much different it would be. Think of all the problems that have arisen in this country because the leader sees that leader as the most important person on the stage. And therefore, other things need to happen that must continually happen. The older generations must always be about passing the mantle of leadership on to the younger generations. And the younger generations must not let that mantle fall down. When Jesus called the 12, he did so because he knew that they would have to build on what he had begun, that this would not be an enterprise that would be finished in his lifetime or even in his disciples' lifetime, but would go on and on and on forever. When he called them to come and follow him, he meant to change the entire world. He didn't hamstring with a lot of traditions and ways of doing things. He simply said, go and make disciples of all the nations, teaching them to do all that I have taught you to do, and observing the commandment that I have given all of you, which is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. And if you do this, you will live. He gave them broad brushstrokes as to what to do. And primarily that means he then gave the power over to the younger generation to figure out how to make that happen in their time and place. It's one of the hardest things I see in institutions for the older generation to give up power to the younger, because there's this tendency to think the younger generation won't do it the way it's been done. And you know what? You're right. It won't be done the way it was done by you, the older generation, or by me, the older generation. It will be done in a new, fresh way, but it will be a way. They have the responsibility to step up to the plate, and I see a lot of people doing that today, which is exciting to me, especially out on the political spectrum. I see young people we've never even heard of yet coming into leadership, running for office. And in the church, too, young folks coming up who have never been there before. And this is good because we know in families that you have to pass on leadership to your children and grandchildren. It works that way all the time. But it's in the church, and in particular, political power struggles that seem to take place that hamper us and our growth. You know, the seven deadly sins in the church are not avarice, greed, gluttony, etc. They are, we've never done it that way before. Those words kill the spirit of innovation. Those words kill anything new that wants to come up, and they instead entomb life. But as James and John soon discovered, the real issue isn't one of who's going to be the greatest. No, the real issue is one of service. Who is going to give the greatest service to the greatest number of people? Who's going to look around and say, you know, who's not yet here that needs to be here in order for the church to continue into the next century? It's going to take vision to look beyond just what we have to see what we really need. And so whoever wants to be first of all of you and me must be last of all and servant of all, Jesus says. So the question to all of us is this: are we willing to be a servant generation, to serve the needs of those that are yet to come up through the ranks? When I look at our kids on Sunday morning who go off to Sunday school, that's who I think of. I want to leave the place better for them. I want them to be able to call this their home. I want them to see this as their spiritual location. Are you willing to think about their needs? What is meaningful for them? And what are we doing to attract them into this, the body of Christ here and now? Later today at 4 o'clock, we will celebrate the life and memory of Isabel Paisley. She was a member here, well, not technically, but she might as well have been. She was married in this church 56 years ago to Bill. She raised her daughters here. They were baptized here. And we put Bill to rest from here, and we will put Isabel to rest from here. To me, that is the mark of a great generation, a generation that leaves the place a bit better for the next generation. And I hope that you'll not only be able to come for that memorial service today at 4, but you'll think about what I've said in terms of what we need to do while we're still here in this time and place. Amen.